Now, the Glass-Steagall Act was a response to the environment of speculation and manipulation and fraud, which led to the crash of Wall Street in 1929. And it, essentially, it's not necessarily a revolution. It's not a social revolution. It's a reform policy of the banking and financial sectors, namely to keep the commercial banks on one end and the merchant banks and stock brokerage companies on the other, and not allow them to coalesce, so that you're keeping the speculators, within the realm of stock markets, money markets, etc., and the commercial banks, their function is to lend money to the real economy. Now, what has happened with the Financial Services Modernization Act is the coalescence is an atmosphere of total deregulation, where these financial institutions can merge. They already merged prior to the adoption of the Act. It's not to say that we still had a very centralized banking system even in the mid-90s. But what they did is that they allowed the commercial banks and the stock brokerage firms to integrate. So it's no longer Chase Manhattan Bank, it's J.P. Morgan Chase, okay? And it's the same thing in Canada. We are in a sort of copy and paste type of mentality. So what do? We copy this legislation, but we do it in a roundabout way. We don't go through any kind of complex legislation. It's done without discussion. I don't think the Canada Bank Act was actually changed as a result, but from one day to the next, you see the merger of stock brokerage firms and banks and insurance companies and accounting firms and eventually the health service providers, so that they called it the financial supermarket. Okay? In other words, you can go into a financial institution and you have so many different products. You can borrow, you can speculate, you can buy an insurance contract on your home, you have various services which are provided, and it's globalized. So most Canadian financial institutions now have emulated this pattern, and so you have TD, Canada Trust, Price Waterhouse. Okay, so they merged the banks with the trust companies, and the trust companies with the stock brokerage firms. The same thing, CIBC, which is not my favorite institution, although I bank there, but that's because the university always had an arrangement with them. But essentially now that they have bought up Manulife, okay? So Manulife and CIBC is the same big conglomerate, and I don't recall their stock brokerage arm. What is it?
Wood Gundy.
Yeah, that's right. So there you have. So that when you have that type of institution in a totally unregulated environment, what do? They form their contiguous hedge funds. They transfer money into the hedge funds. They move offshore. All these banks have, and that's not something which is recent, they have their affiliates in the Cayman Islands, which is the fourth largest banking financial center in the world. With it, more financial institutions than there are inhabitants. That's maybe an overstatement. Establishing financial entities such as the hedge funds, which escape total regulation, which don't need to open their books. And on top of that, you have, and that's not recent either, you have an environment which favors money laundering. There are different types of processes of money laundering. Let me describe them. There's several colors of money. There's black money, which is, in French, is l'argent au noir. That's money which escapes taxation. And you'll see that the news reports always talk about workers au noir. But the financial institutions are doing it on a very large scale. And the companies are doing it on a large scale. I mean, they move their money, and they do it in a way which is legit. You see, they have they have insurance companies in the Channel Islands, and then they have the Cayman Islands, and then some of the companies have their head offices there, and so on, so that they can escape taxation at will, and they do it so-called legally, and they establish the haven, they establish themselves in these various havens. And then, of course, you have what we call dirty money. Dirty money is money of criminal origin, and that is not negligible because it's the proceeds of the drug trade, which is then reinvested into real estate, tourism, and in fact, anything. You can launder money in any activity, okay? In effect, financial institutions, that's their bread and butter. Regulators will close their eyes on the money laundering process while paying lip service to drug eradication. But in effect, we know that this narcotics economy is tremendously large. It serves very powerful interests. And the two major drug producing economies in the world today are Colombia in the Andean region, but Colombia is the major distributor. And the second one is Afghanistan, impoverished country, but which creates, I've made the estimate, something of the order of between $150 and $200 billion a year is the proceeds of the Afghan drug trade. So there's also that's where war and economics comes together. There are some very powerful vested interests behind the development of the drug trade in Afghanistan, which has increased something of the order of 35-fold since the U.S. occupation. Okay, if we compare that to the levels of drug production prevailing under the Taliban government, which went down in history as the government which implemented the most successful drug eradication program. I'm not apologizing for them, I'm just stating a fact. They brought it down by 93%, but immediately when U.S. troops entered Afghanistan, the levels of narcotics production went up to sky high to their historical levels and 30 times. Today, it has gone from 182 tons in 2001 to something like 6,500 in the current context. So this brings us to the rescue operations. The rescue operations I'll discuss a little bit the one. The rescue operation applied in the United States. These are the rescue operations which are intended to stabilize markets and restore financial stability. But these rescue operations are largely handouts to financial institutions. In the United States, the Troubled Assets Relief Program is of the order of $700 billion. But in effect, One has estimated that they are substantially larger than that. We're talking about something of the order of 8.5 trillion. Okay, some of that is out of Treasury, some of it is Federal Reserve. It's a complex menu of financial injections, but I think we must understand very clearly that where did I put my dollar bill? Okay. We must understand very clearly that this situation will leads us into a spiraling public debt. And I'd like to again address that question. If you look at the U.S. situation, but I'll mention the U.S. situation, and then we can discuss a little bit the Canadian situation, because in effect, the situation in Canada is far less transparent. Okay, in the United States they had a debate in the U.S. Congress. I'm not apologizing for the U.S. Political system, but they had the honesty of a legislative debate. They passed a law. They had the Troubled Assets Relief Program, which is supported by a piece of legislation. First, they voted against it, then they accepted it, and they actually publicized the amounts that were going to be handed to the banks. Okay, it was on CNN. So you can't accuse them of misinformation or disinformation. The question is, when you have troubled assets relief, $700 billion, defense spending of the order of $1 trillion plus, interest payments on the national debt of the order of $400 billion, and various other allocations, handouts which are not as transparent as the TARP, the government, the federal government in the United States admits that that they're talking about something in excess of $1 trillion. But again, other estimates suggest that these bailouts, in effect, are in the order of several trillion dollars, not all of them going through Treasury. But if you want to address the ones going through Treasury, you have to understand immediately that if you hand out the $700 billion to Bank of America and Chase, JP Morgan Chase, and so on, okay, you can look at the composition of where this money goes. This comes out of Treasury. It is a component of government spending, right? Now, if it's a component of government spending, there are two ways of financing it. One way is to issue government bonds and treasury bills at 0% interest rate, okay? Yeah, right. Virtually, that's what it is. So, or what the other way of funding it is to, I'm talking about under the present setup, because you can't borrow from the Federal Reserve Bank. So that debt is held by the public. So you have to issue public debt to finance the handouts. And so essentially it means that the public debt is going to go up astronomically, unless, and that is the other scenario, unless you proceed with a massive slashing of all categories of public expenditure with the exception of defense, okay? Because that's a no-no. So I suspect that what we are going to have is a combination of a massive increase in the public debt due to the financing of the handouts, and as I said, that's only the tip of the iceberg, these $700 billion. And again, it's going to trigger a major restructuring of every single category of expenditure. Well, in essence, in the United States, social programs are virtually already more or less at the bone, and there's not much to cut. Now, let's discuss the Canadian... Please give me back my money, thank you. Now, let's discuss the Canadian bailout. Now, I would suspect that virtually nobody in Canada knows that there has been a Canadian bailout.
Of course.
And I'd like to indicate to you that there was a Canadian bailout to the Canadian chartered banks. It is of the order, it was announced on the Friday prior to the federal elections. On a Friday, and the elections were on a Tuesday, I can't recall the exact dates, but it was it back in October, right? Yeah. And the first installment was $25 billion. It is technically under the auspices of Central Housing and Mortgage. But it is a cash, it said it's guaranteed, but it's money that the chartered banks can immediately draw on. So it is a cash handout. And it does imply the same logic as that pertaining to the $700 billion under the Troubled Assets Relief Program. It was first 25 billion, and then they added additional amounts. And 2 weeks after the elections, they came out with another announcement, and the office of the finance minister confirms that we're talking about $75 billion of bailout money available for the Canadian chartered banks. And there you can see the copy and paste type of mentality, because it's a 10%. It's pro rata to population, approximately. Okay, I haven't calculated it exactly, but 700 billion in the States, 75 now. So it has a sort of pro rata flavor to it, and we must understand that Canadian financial institutions are part of the same financial architecture. What do the banks do with this money? They go out and buy other banks. CIBC, TD, Canada Trust go out on a shopping spree. They're acquiring troubled banks in the United States and so on. That is money to the banks. Again, it's financed. The mechanism may be a little bit indirect because it's through central housing and mortgage, but it's nonetheless an outlay to the financial institutions, which is financed by taxpayers' money. And then we have to then address the issue, how does a $70 billion handout to financial institutions affect the system of the federal fiscal financial structure? And the irony is that both in Quebec and the federal government, while this was happening, and it was announced in a very small way, it didn't make any headlines or anything, you could have Jean Charest and the Bloc Québécois and Harper, they were talking about how many millions they would be allocating to health. They weren't talking about billions, okay? Say, well, we need $13.5 million to refurbish this, that, and other. And all the electoral promises as far as social expenditures were in the millions. And then all of a sudden, $70 billion was in the, you know, at page 15 of the financial news, and nobody knows about it. I don't think many people, who knows about the $75 billion? Okay, maybe 10%. Well, these people here are experts, but the broader public don't know about it. Okay? It hasn't been discussed anywhere. There have been no discussions in Parliament. Of course, the Parliament is closed right now for obvious reasons. But one would expect that that opposition politicians, that Jack Layton might say, well, I think we could have used that money for health care. Okay, that's the kind of thing they should say. We could have used the $70 billion to finance Medicare. Okay, I would have expected that. Politically, it's a good statement to make, okay? But no, they didn't, because they didn't even read the dispatches, and they don't understand the mechanism of injection of this cash into the system. And what I'm saying is that this, we're not dealing with the structure of the mid-90s, where you had federal-provincial transfers affected by Paul Martin's 95 budget. You're dealing with a major upheaval in the structure of the federal fiscal system, namely that the federal government, to finance these handouts, is going to cut all transfers to the provinces. Okay, I mean it's going to be a massive austerity measures, and so that when they come up and said, "Well, we might have a deficit," or we're going to run on a surplus. I mean, it changed. It's absolute nonsensical. The deficit is already built into these figures. It's obvious. And to finance the handouts to the banks, you have to essentially either issue massive amounts of government bonds and treasury bills, or slash virtually every other category of expenditure except defense, which means essentially slash on federal-provincial transfers, the so-called péréquation. Okay? And that means that we are in a scenario of privatization of social services. We're in a scenario where major state assets is likely to be sold off and privatized, of course, at a very reasonable price to the private sector. I suspect that in Quebec, that will be Hydro-Québec, okay? Because that's the big asset. They're going to start. They're already talking about it. But the creditors will say, well, listen, if you want, you can't. You've got such a big deficit, you have to sell off your assets. And so that, and in turn, when the state as a functioning body, which serves the public in terms of social services, support to the business sector, etc., we are of course also in the scenario of a major, as I mentioned earlier, major restructuring of the real economy, where these financial actors will virtually start picking up pieces, buying up companies which have been ransacked either in the financial markets or who are no longer able to function because they can't get credit from the interbank credit market. Now, let me complete, I've gone far past the time. Let me just say one more thing. In all the media reports that you hear, they say, oh, the debts of the banks, etc. Nobody ever talks about who the creditors are. We don't know necessarily who the creditors are because it's a very deregulated network, okay? But there are people who hold those debts. People and institutions hold those debts. They are creditors. We're not going after the creditors. We're not trying to question the legitimacy of these creditors, but the debts don't occur simply like that. There is an interbank debt, but there are interbank creditors. Some of them may be the financial institutions, which have made mass profits in the last few years. And then there are more shady institutions, such as these private hedge funds, which also hold a lot of these debts, and which they'll never cash in on all of them because the derivative exposure is in the trillions. It's in excess of 100 trillion. But what they will do is that they will use their position as creditors to buy up the wealth, the productive wealth of the real economy. And that is where people like Warren Buffett will come in, his richest man on earth, and he'll buy up General Motors. He's already doing it. Okay? And the irony is that he goes through a Swiss company specializing in solar energy, who then acquires a stake in General Motors on his behalf. So it's all done in a very devious way. So again, and the impact, of course, the impact on employment, the impact on social services is going to be absolutely devastating. And I think we have to be prepared to respond in a meaningful way to this crisis. First of all, in an understanding of the crisis, but also in actions which ultimately lead to disarming. Well, Keynes used the term financial disarmament, which was really to disarm the speculative apparatus. And there are certain measures which could be implemented very expediently, which at least would reverse the tide within the existing system. But the power configuration at this stage doesn't allow it for the reasons I mentioned right at the beginning. These are very powerful constellation of forces. They're embedded with the military, with the oil companies, and ultimately they also control the political apparatus in different parts of the world. Thank you very much for your attention.
That was Michel Chesedowski, professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, speaking in late January. That recording comes courtesy of his organization, globalresearch.ca, an excellent site for news and analysis. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD, Kasilof, Anchorage, WZKW, Kingsville, KOWA, Olympia, WRFN, Nashville, WUOW, Oneonta, KRBS, Oroville, WKNH, Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. We'll conclude the program by returning to Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. This is an excerpt from a recent episode of their weekly radio show, The Truth About Markets. Max Kaiser is a former Wall Street stockbroker, and in this clip, he discusses some of the ways in which the finance industry deliberately defrauds customers and the way in which the financial system is deliberately designed to empty the pockets of the many into the pockets of the few through the mechanism of financial crisis.
You know, the major media is great at putting out the propaganda because, you know, this meme out there, this idea put out by the mainstream media that we have the people have no choice because, after all, you just can't let them fail. You know, the government has to bail them out because it would be much worse to just let them fail. And this is remarkable because the major mainstream media have gotten the American public to buy into policies that guarantee their impoverishment. And it's just a testament to the triumph of mainstream media to push out any dissenting voice or any debate or any kind of public service that you would think would be inherently obligatory for a public airwave to adhere to. They've been the public airwaves, which started out as a public utility, more or less, have been, of course, co-opted by the corporate agenda, and now serve purely at the behest of the propaganda meisters in Washington and in the banking system, who put out these ridiculous, these ludicrous ideas that, oh, we just can't let them fail. And anybody who now has seen their monthly income go drop by 90% due to the drop in short-term interest rates by the banking system, the people who are now starving because their monthly income has been slashed by 80 or 90%, these people have had their monthly income slashed for no reason other than to bail out these bankers. So when you say that, well, we couldn't let them fail, you have to understand that simultaneously, you have to understand that you, the individual who's had your monthly income slashed, is where the money is coming from. You are subsidizing the Merrill Lynch bonuses and the Wall Street bonuses. And not only have you had your money stolen, but then you turn around and defend the crooks. And this has got to be the very nature of this whole idea of the Stockholm Syndrome, where the person who's been kidnapped falls in love with their captor. The American people have been kidnapped by the banking system, and now they're defending the banking system while the banking system steals their money in the form of driving interest rates low to bail out banks who have kept afloat this enormous slush fund scheme, unnumbered accounts that are simply there to launder money, launder losses. And what I speak of, I know, having worked in a brokerage office for many years. You know, I'll just run through it again quickly. When I worked on Wall Street, you know, I can tell you every office has a compliance officer. The compliance officer is meant to oversee the brokers in that office to make sure that they are compliant with SEC laws and Securities Act of 1933 and 1934 and all the subsequent Securities Acts, meant to provide checks and balances and safeguards for the brokers to be acting in ways that are commensurate with the interests of their clients, to be behaving in what's called a fiduciary capacity, and to be acting in the interest of their clients. And every single Christmas, every single broker makes a cash gift to the compliance officer to have them look the other way while they completely work around the system and game the system and defraud the system. The compliance officer and the compliance desk of any brokerage office, which is there to protect the customer, is turned into a profit center in its own right. By, for example, I'll give you an example, Stacy.
Go ahead, Max.
Let's say there's a Merrill office or some big brokerage firm office out there, and they've got, let's say, 50 brokers working in that office. And as happens from time to time, brokers cut deals and they go to other firms. So, you know, some other big firm offers a broker some money to go and work at the other firm, some cash. During that process, of course, the broker has to move their accounts. They have to move. They've got a book of, let's say, 200 or 300 accounts. They've got to have those 200 or 300 people sign new account forms and move those accounts over to the new firm. And it's tricky business to get people to sign off on all those documents and move them on to the new firm. And what happens is when a broker does leave an office and go to another firm, there's the management of the firm, of the office where the broker is working, will call in a few of his other brokers, and he'll take those 200 or 300 accounts, pages from the book, he'll distribute it to those few brokers, and he says, he makes them the following deal. For the next 3 or 6 months, any business you do in these accounts, we're going to pay you double or triple what we were paying you ordinarily, because brokers keep a percentage of the commissions that they generate. Typically, in the United States, brokers keep 40 cents of every dollar in commissions that they make. The firm takes 60 cents of every dollar. What happens is, in the deal that I just suggested, the management might say, we're going to give you not 40%, but we might give you 80% or even 120% of all the commission dollars you generate in these accounts for the next 3 or 6 months. This motivates the brokers in the office to do a lot of business as quickly as possible, quote unquote, churning these accounts to keep them locked in to the firm so that they're not moved to the new firm. And this takes two forms. Number one is immediately what the brokers do to all the accounts is they go in there into the records and they change all the data. So they'll change the date of birth, they'll change addresses, they'll change all kinds of information that was given by the customer to the firm when the account was open. Why? Because when the transfer of an account form comes in from the new firm, it doesn't match the data on the existing brokerage firm. So the transfer doesn't go through and it delays the transfer or invalidates the transfer. So that gives the broker more time or an indefinite amount of time to keep churning that account. So they create a lot of bad data in the account. Also, very common in brokerage firms throughout the country is forgery. Most of the documents that clients are required to sign off, let's say an options agreement, a margin agreement, a new account agreement, all these agreements, by and large, most of those documents are forged. Very few of those documents are the actual signatures of customers. What happens during a transfer situation like that is suddenly documents that may have been signed or not been signed or lost, they're suddenly thrown up and into the discussion, and that delays the process or invalidates the process. Or there's a question of signatures not matching, and that, of course, delays the process. So that's one way to keep the accounts locked in. And by simultaneously kind of making it from the customer, of course, now has an account that's completely, listed at the firm in ways that are not correct, and that causes complications, of course. The second idea, of course, The second way that the brokers lock the customers into the account is obviously you do a lot of trades and you get out of all the positions that the customer was in, because when the transfer form comes in, it lists the positions that the customer holds. If the positions are no longer there, then the transfer paper is invalid. Also, if it's a cash account and the transfer form comes in, but the account is now on margin, that is, you've leveraged up the account by 10, 20, 30, 40, 50%, that also makes it another layer of difficulty in transferring the account. So there's an incentive for the brokers who still have these accounts to put them up on margin, put them up on leverage, and change all the stocks immediately. So you get a call from your broker typically, Stacey. You'll say, and also there's a lot of an additional layer of fraud in that the broker will call up you, the customer, and say, hey, your broker, Joe Bag of Donuts, just went to a new firm. And the reason he went to a new firm is they'll say something slanderous, like he was discovered to be doing something inappropriate. They'll just completely slander the guy. And as a result, you know, we need to kind of construct your portfolio. And the customer's like, he doesn't know any better. And they'll say, gee, what do you recommend? Well, we need to sell everything in the account. And we need to set up a new account, which is based on really what the firm is recommending, because your old broker was, you know, completely off the reservation there and going down, you know, the wrong path. So the customer, most of the time, not knowing really what's going on, they'll just say, yeah, well, okay. So now the broker is selling everything out full commission. They're buying new stuff at full commission. They're probably going to leverage the account up to put it on margin, and they're falsifying documents. This makes it virtually impossible to move that account to the new firm. So now it's locked into the old firm. But all this trading activity, all this churning, Stacey, in the accounts, invariably mistakes are made, and you end up buying stuff in error. Or the customer will call back and say, you know what? I didn't really give you an authorization to make those trades. They give you, it becomes what's known as a DK, which is Wall Street slang for declines knowledge, which means that the customer is saying it was an unauthorized trade at that point. So if the customer comes in and says, that was an unauthorized trade, I didn't say to do that. That was not, then the broker goes to the manager and says, okay, I got a DK on customer X, Y, and Z. And so what happens is the trade is busted and it's put into the unnumbered slush fund account over at the compliance officer's desk. So during this phase of churning and falsifying documents and keeping the customer in the firm for these 3 or 6 months during the high payout season, there's a lot of busted trades, a lot of DKs, and they accumulate in the back office. Some of them offset others. Like some of the busted trades will be positive. You know, there'll be a winning busted trade. Some of them are losing busted trades. And at the end of the month, the idea is hopefully the losers outnumber the winners. And but it's all off the books, and it's not recorded anywhere officially in the firm's P&L, on the office's P&L. So, I mean, it's completely an invisible transaction, more or less. It's all done through these unnumbered accounts. And but what happens is typically because it's so sloppy that you end up, of course, at the end of the month with a lot more losses than you had to start with. And then this is where the magic of the IPO comes in. So one of the great tricks of Wall Street is to wash over mistakes with initial public offerings. A lot of people are very curious why deals come to market and they're so cheap relative to their first day price appreciation. You know, during the dot-com boom, of course, you had those amazing stories of companies going public at $15, and they would open, the first trade would be at $50 or $60. The average first day pop for dot-com stocks in the late 90s was something like 300%. Just an enormous. So the question is, well, how come they mispriced the deal so incredibly? How come didn't the people going public get shortchanged because they could have priced the deal a lot higher? Well, part of the racketeering that goes on Wall Street is they convince the people going public that they should allow them to price the deal at what they consider to be the right price. And these huge one-day pops are then used as payola. So let's say, and the payola is very useful, because let's say going back to my previous example, if you had a customer who you retained at the firm, who because the broker went to another firm, and during the process of rolling him over to a new portfolio and leveraging him up, you incurred some huge loss, much bigger loss than we could offset in any other way. Customers could be sitting on a big, big loss. Now the customer not only is decaying the trades, but he's talking about, you know, going to arbitration, you know, and suing. By the way, typically in the customers on Wall Street, when they sign a new account form, they are obligated to take all complaints and grievances to an arbitration panel. That you can't outright sue the broker. It has to go through arbitration, and the arbitration panel is stacked by, guess who, brokers and bankers. Very, very few customers successfully sue their brokers because it all goes through an in-house arbitration panel. Something like 2% of complaints end up successful for that very reason. That's another lobbying effort, thanks to, you know, the wonderful Washington Wall Street axis of weasels. So anyway, the customer, nevertheless, is getting agitated. He's got some huge loss. And so then the broker, what the broker can say is, look, you know, we recognize the fact that we haven't given you great service. So there's a deal coming. You know, it's a company. It's a hot IPO for a technology company. And I can put 1,000 or 2,000 or 10,000 shares in your account. And lo and behold, on the first day of trading, that the IPO is up 200 or 300%. And now magically, the customer who was sitting on a $100,000 loss, they've been made whole. So that's just pure payola. So now the customer says, oh, that's great. Well, thanks so much. I guess that solves our problem, and we don't have a problem anymore. The broker, of course, makes commissions all around. They never stop making commissions. They make commissions on the IPO. They make commissions on all the trades. They make commissions on all the busted trades, all the DK trades. They're just making commissions on all this. And the customer who went IPO is happy because, of course, they have this new stock that's floating out there on the exchange. They sold out of their part of their company, and they've made millions and millions of dollars. And this mountain of slush fund activity, this freight train of fraud that's been rolling down Wall Street for 25 years, which is the length of the bull market that ended, you know, a year and a half ago. This has all been building up for 25 years, where every single time there's been a crisis, either the micro and the macro of this picture is the same. You know, the frauds that are committed with the individual broker and the individual customers are the same frauds that are committed with on the institutional level. So when you hear about people like Robert Citrone in California, who turned that municipality bankrupt, it's because he was sold a lot of bad stuff from Wall Street in the exact same manner I just described. When countries discover that they've, you know, these banks in Europe who are now discovering they own hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars worth of bad collateralized debt obligations, it's the exact same situation. They were sold this stuff from bankers on Wall Street in the City of London in the exact same way, who just treat these countries like individual brokers treat their book of clients. They're just rubes. They're just people to force junk into. They're just junk waste baskets. And they're just at the other end of a factory of sludge. And they just push it in down their throat. And I've used the example of ducks on a foie gras farm. They're just pushing all this grain of fraud paper down their throats. Now, why hasn't the system blown up sooner? The answer is because you got to go back to the 70s and early 80s, because in the 70s and early 80s, the system that had been abused during the 60s and 70s during the Vietnam War was, if you remember, in the mid-70s, there was stagflation in the U.S. and there was inflation, and interest rates under Volcker had to be pushed up to the 16 to 17% level to rectify all the abuses of that period. And when Greenspan came into the Federal Reserve chair position, he had the luxury of overseeing a Fed and a U.S. economy that over the ensuing 25 years would see interest rates put a trend down, and that therefore bonds were trending up for that period of time. He had a 25-year bull market in bonds. And because you had the bull market in bonds, you had the ability to commit all these frauds for 25 years and have them not show up in the general economy, because ultimately all of the losses could be laundered using interest rate arbitrage due to the fact that bond prices were going up and interest rates were coming down. The reason why everything is coming apart now is because the bond market rally is effectively over. The era of cheap money is over. The era of all of these accounting scams and tricks is over. And as Warren Buffett has said, when the tide goes out, you see who's not wearing his bathing suit, and the tide is now going out. And all of the dirty underworld and seamy underbelly of this entire system is now visible for people to see, and it's quite shocking. And we're just at the very beginning of it. And I believe we're talking about, because all these banks join together all of their slush fund activities, and it's all working on all the institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, Goldman, JP Morgan, Merrill, Bank of America, Citi, the City of London, Wall Street, Sumitomo Bank, Bank of Japan, all of the major banks, all the central banks, the Bank of International Settlements, all these Swiss banks, which are now coming under attack. All these things have been colluding for years to create something in the order of a $700 trillion, three-quarters of a quadrillion-dollar error account, unnumbered error account, in a global economy that's only roughly, you know, $50 trillion in GDP.
You know, I'm going back to what I feel is an engineered crisis, because it just seems like there's only one end to this, and it seems like outright collapse. There seems no positive end to this situation. If savers or anybody with pensioners, any of these people, you know, they're not only taking away the savings income, the interest income, but now, you know, the stock market has collapsed as well. So anybody with a pension pot in equities, they've been decimated. But where's that, you know, that huge gap between the 0.5% official interest rates with the 17, 18, 30% they're charging on credit cards? You know, this is just banks printing money for themselves at this point.
Right. Well, when interest rates are going up, of course, they raise the rate that they would charge you on your credit card.
But they never took it back down.
And when rate, because it's tied to the official government interest rates. Now, when rates are coming down, they're saying, well, we're not going to lower rates on your credit card just because interest rates are down, but we will lower the rate you're getting on your savings account. Now, that's just outright fraud. That's just outright fraud. I mean, and just if 2 million people can go out into the streets and protest against the Iraq war, as they did before the Iraq war in London, these people are only tangentially affected by the Iraq war. I mean, the people in Iraq were getting bombed. They weren't, the people in London were not getting bombed. The people in Iraq were getting bombed. But on moral principles, they were out in the streets, 2 million of them, protesting the war. Now, here's a situation where you've got a group of bankers who are committing massive fraud, who are stealing money from you. Quite clearly, that rates are going down, but they're not only not lowering credit card rates, but in some cases, they're raising rates. So you have less money to buy food, and you have less money to buy medical attention. So you are actually experiencing true duress as a result of this attack by bankers, and yet nobody is out in the street protesting for themselves.
The media and the government are already putting out the propaganda, preparing for that, and they're like they're scaring pensioners and savers who tend to be more respectable, or, you know, if you have a pension account, if you have any money saved, you might be like somebody who fits into the community. But so they're trying to put fear of them into them about protesting, because I don't know if you've seen over the last 2 weeks the allegations from MI5 that there are going to be bank riots this summer, and it's caused by all this the financial crisis, and on top of that the banker bonuses. And they said that they fear that middle class people you know, self-respecting, normal, like upstanding community members will become the foot soldiers of radical elements and radical environmentalists and these sorts. So they're already putting it out in the press that if you protest against this, you know, controlled demolition of our economy, you're actually a radical activist. You're one of these radical people.
Oh, the bankers and lawyers and politicians who are controlling the demolition, they didn't get there because they're stupid. They got there because they've studied propaganda throughout history. They studied military tactics throughout history. They've studied banking. They know how to operate a sweep of the wealth of the people in this manner. So they know what they're doing, and the people unfortunately are easily bought off. You know, they're like it's like they're walking into a Roach Motel. You know, Roach Motel is just a box with some glue in it, and the glue smells like cheese or whatever, and the roaches walk in there and they can't get out. Now, the vast majority of the British population simply walks into the Roach Motel of buying into this notion that their government and their bankers are operating under some fiduciary responsibility with their interest at heart. And then they get stuck in having their money in a bank where the banker is saying, either you allow us to continue to defraud our customers, or we're going to blow this bank up and we're going to blow up this country. And that's basically the underlying message coming from the bankers in America, certainly. They've said, going back to the late Bush administration and Hank Paulson, when he initially got that $700 billion in bailout money, the message quite clearly was, either give us this money tonight or we're going to drop the stock market down by a few thousand points. Well, they got the money, and the stock market still went down a few thousand points. And they're going to continue to get the money, and the stock market will continue to drop by thousands of points because they are extortionists.
Yeah, they'll do it all the way down until it's exactly like where the Great Depression was, something like 90% down. And then you'll give your final $5 trillion to them then. And then the market will start to recover. And they'll say, see, we told you, if you just give us the money, it would recover.
Right. Well, then there'll just be a massive transfer of wealth to all the people out there in the last 20, 25 years who started buying stocks and had pension accounts and self-directed accounts, and they own stocks in their accounts. All the values will be taken down by 90%. Those people will be forced to sell out to pay for basic daily needs. Those stocks will be trading at multi-decade lows. And then suddenly, all the money that the banks took from the government that they did not use to make loans, they're hoarding the cash on their balance sheets. Again, in these unnumbered accounts are just brimming with government money. Once stock market's down 90%, suddenly they'll say, oh, you know what? Here we looked and looked and looked for a couple of years and we couldn't find the money, but we just found it. It's in this unnumbered account that we forgot about. Oh, it's $500 billion. I think we'll just buy some stocks here. And it's too late that everyone else had to sell out at the bottom. Now we own it all. And everyone else is quite broke by this. And they're going to have to work for us for pennies on the dollar because they've got no unions, no savings, and no interest rate, no capital. And they've been totally disenfranchised, and they're basically serfs on our plantation. And guess what? It wasn't an accident. It's totally scripted by power grabs that have been done throughout history. It's just amazing that the general population, even in an age today, in previous ages, you could say, well, the reason that people get ripped off like this every 20 years or 50 years or 100 years is because there's no body of information. Then there's no historical records of this, you know, because then, but today with the internet, anyone with an internet access can look up how do populations get defrauded by banks, and you can just read about it throughout history. And that's the amazing part about it, is that the accumulated knowledge of those people who have been ripped off over the ages has meant absolutely nothing to defend today's population against getting ripped off in the exact same way. But there doesn't seem to be any ability by the community at large to defend itself from the psychosis and the parasitical activities of a group of homicidal terrorist bankers.
Yeah, but that's because we've been so atomized, and you know, we're in our own little individual bubble, and you think, You know, that if I just keep my head down and just keep speculating on this property and it keeps on going up, you know, I know bubbles crash, but it'll be somebody else. I'll get out. I'm smart enough to get out first.
Yeah, and then the other button they push is the imaginary enemy button.
Yeah. Well, that's been very obvious. That has helped keep this bubble going for the last few years.
Well, it certainly was helpful after 9/11 was to create the imaginary enemy, and therefore we needed to drop interest rates to 1% and keep them low for a very long time. That was ultimately what led to the collapse of Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and started this current crisis, was the fact that after 9/11, interest rates were dropped to 1% and kept there for way, way, way too long. And as I've said on this show before, my feeling about that, you've got two possible scenarios. Number one is, under the cover of fighting so-called war on terror, the bankers in Washington realized that they could drop interest rates to ridiculously low levels and justify that action as a means toward fighting terrorism. Or number two, the thinking was at the time by the bankers in Washington that we have to show the so-called bad guys that they didn't win, quote-unquote, on 9/11. So to defy them, to show America that they didn't beat us, we're going to drop interest rates down to 1%, which will get people shopping. And if you remember, George Bush stood on the rubble on the 9/11 day and encouraged people to shop. That was their big response, because the American way, apparently, by then in the history of America, the American ethos had been reduced basically to one word: shopping. And to defend the American flag meant to shop. To defend American values meant to shop. To defend one's home and family meant to shop. And this is all the only message Bush carried with him was.
Yeah, I think it was intentional. I think it was, you know, Bush, not only did he have the oil men, and that was part of it, but I think it was also, you know, it was these bankers, people behind the banks, that it was an engineered theft of the entire wealth of the entire Western world, every single person with a credit card. It was their, you know, you're into the matrix. You were plugging in and giving them everything of your entire net worth. You know, they shocked you. You were in a catatonic state. You were hypnotized. And they said, go shop. How many people? Go to maxkaiser.com. Look on the front page. And we have several quotes from the head of the Dallas Fed, the head of the St. Louis Fed. Why were the Federal Reserve chairman saying things like, go shop? Why were they telling you to go buy an SUV? Why were they using
They're giving a massive tax credit to buy an SUV.
Yeah, exactly. But why were they using this moment of shock and catatonia and hypnotism to tell you to go shop? Why? Because they were intentionally draining you. You were like you were being traumatized. You were being manipulated, brainwashed. You were brainwashed into handing over everything, and they were taking it. It was just pouring right into their lap, which was pouring into the Cayman Islands.
Right. I mean, if you go shopping and you rack up debts to go shopping, well, the thing that you're buying, whether it's a car or a flat screen TV, will depreciate in value rather quickly. But the debts carry on for decades. And that's the spread or the arbitrage that enacted and enabled the transfer of wealth from the vast majority of Americans to a few bankers in Washington, because the stuff that people were buying on credit dissipated in value much faster than the debts are ever going to be paid off.
Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert, hosts of Truth About Markets on Resonance FM in London. You can hear their show online at karmabankradio.com. Bank is spelled BANQUE. And you can download an MP3 of this show at unwelcomeguests.org. Thank you for listening.